Welcome to Remedy and Rhyme, where the voices of poetry and plants entwine, offering nourishment for the spirit and a gentle return to the heart of nature. I'm your host, Kimberly Kling of Joyful Roots, clinical and community herbalist. I'm so glad you've joined me here to share in the stories, reflections, and simple ways these green allies can nurture our everyday lives. This podcast is for educational and inspirational purposes only. I'm not a medical doctor or a licensed health professional, and nothing shared here is intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any disease. The information provided has not been evaluated by the FDA. Herbs are powerful allies, but not without personality. If you experience an allergic reaction or discomfort from any herb mentioned, please stop using it. Also, if you're taking medications, check with your doctor about potential herb-drug interactions. Most importantly, you and you alone are the steward of your own body. What you choose to consume, apply, or integrate is entirely up to you. This is about health empowerment. Listen with curiosity and always honor your own body's wisdom. These episodes are dropped the second Wednesday of every month, and to go along with this podcast, I have a Patreon community where you can join me to explore these plants deeper. Find that at patreon.com/joyfulroots. Hi, and thank you so much for joining me for this episode of Remedy and Rhyme. During this episode, we are going to talk all about the incredible conundrum that is comfrey. Comfrey is a plant that has been grown for eons in people's gardens, and I'm excited to get into the heart of why comfrey helps us knit the broken places back together. It's our custom to start each episode with a poem, so here we go. This poem is called Calling on Community, and it's written by me, Kimberly Kling. I'm in bed with the enemy. It wasn't my plan all along, but the situation changed. Promises and purpose melted into deceit and lies. The foggy clouds of hope lifted into clarity. I lit a candle for the world. It blew out on its own, time and time again. Maybe the air wasn't thick enough to lift our prayers to the wind. After so many years, trump cards being played, bending the rules, trick-taking tactics that had us all fooled, wars keep raging, and our hearts keep shattering. Glass towers exploding into a million pieces, pieces of our hearts, worn and weary, held together by tension. Now, the smallest pressure has catastrophic consequences. I've replaced hope with faith. Faith that although no leader leads us to glory, the billions of us, small and mighty, wake up to the enormity of our strength. Faith that when the storms come and the winds rage, when the hail pours down, we will hug our neighbors, gather what's left of those fragmented hearts, and know that we are the prayers we've been waiting for. This poem was obviously somewhat inspired by different events that we as a humanity have been experiencing on this planet that just seem to keep accelerating. Floods and fire, war, ravaged communities. But when I've watched the news and when I've listened to people who've been through these situations, what I always see shine so brightly is this aspect of community and how it's the community that knits together the broken places. They knit together what needs mending and take care of each other. In many instances, we even see people that are, you know, could be considered quote-unquote enemies coming together to build community and repair damages that have been done to help one another. We can witness people from different political spectrums, different cultural backgrounds, different religions, all coming together to help each other in our shared humanity. And I feel like that's what comfrey does really well. So I'd like to get into how comfrey relates to this idea of knitting the broken pieces back together, how weaving brings strength, how autonomy can be achieved through interdependence, and also this idea of working together with our enemies for a common good. Comfrey's old name is knitbone. I love how our ancestors told us exactly what plants are capable of in their historical names. The plant doesn't just comfort what's broken, it goes to work reweaving it. That's the doorway I'd like to step through in this episode. What does it mean to be the one in a community who knits or weaves, and how can we bring all parts of community together to create healing? I love the analogy of woven fabric. A weave holds a relationship where every strand is still moving among its neighbors, still bearing its own tension, but locked into a pattern that can carry weight none of them could carry on their own. Strength isn't one dominant thing imposing order. It's many separate fibers of tissue being called into proliferation together, at the same time, at the site of the break or the unraveling. Community isn't about one strong node holding everyone else up. It takes many parts to build strength, like a tight weave made of many beautiful but synchronizing colors. It's about calling on every part, the ones that seem broken, the ones that seem too soft, the ones that seem unrelated to the wound at all, and combining them into the same act of rebuilding at once. Now, I know if you've ever worked within a community, this certainly seems like an art form, one in which the artist or a good leader doesn't administer the entire project. They conduct and inform the project so that each part can do the work it's meant to do. This is how I think of Comfrey. Comfrey builds strength in a similar way. Each component of the plant works together as an art form, a great weaving to knit together what needs mending. There are many, many components in the plant, some of which we know, like allantoin, the compound known famously for cell proliferation and tissue regeneration, and some compounds which still remain a mystery. Herbalists have leaned on comfrey for centuries, long before anyone could name what was actually doing the work. The plant was trusted on relationship and result, not on isolated chemistry. Even now, with allantoin and rosmarinic acid identified and studied, researchers still can't fully account for comfrey's effect through those constituents alone. Something in the synergy of the whole plant seems to outperform its named parts. Maybe that's fitting for this thread. A community's healing power isn't always traceable to one identifiable active ingredient. Sometimes the strength is in the whole weave, working in a way none of us can fully isolate or name. Comfrey's taproot goes down several feet, farther than most of its neighbors can reach. It is, in a real sense, self-sufficient. It doesn't need the topsoil everyone else is competing over, but it doesn't hoard that reach either. Chop and drop the leaves and it becomes mulch for your garden, feeding the very community it doesn't depend on for survival. That's a precise image of autonomy through interdependence. Comfrey isn't strong despite being networked into the guild, and it isn't networked because it's weak and needs support. It's autonomous. It has its own deep, independent source, and it chooses interdependence anyway, as a gift rather than a need. It's kind of asking, what would it look like to give to our community from surplus and sovereignty, rather than from depletion or obligation? Comfrey carries both allantoin, the regenerating compound that I mentioned earlier, and pyrrolizidine alkaloids, the liver toxic compounds that led the FDA in 2001 to advise manufacturers to pull internal comfrey products from the market entirely. Both the ally and the enemy live in the same plant, in the same tissue. It's not one thing wearing a friendly mask over a dangerous one, it's genuinely both at once in the same plant. This speaks to the idea of being in bed with the enemy, or being able to embrace both the good and the bad together, because they are, in a sense, a whole package. What strikes me about this isn't just that comfrey is dangerous and helpful simultaneously, it's that for centuries people used it internally anyway, trusting the gifts without fully understanding the mechanism of the harm. It took modern chemistry to isolate exactly what made this plant risky, and once we could name it precisely, the response wasn't, oh, let's learn the dose or learn what's appropriate. It was, oh, let's remove it entirely. And I do understand why to a degree. Pyrrolizidine alkaloids are firmly established hepatotoxins, and there is real concern about these compounds. But our modern culture has a way of making everything really black and white, two opposite ends of the spectrum. Is it possible that there's a place somewhere within those two ends where a balance can be found? It seems to me that there's a lesson in that response pattern. When we can't easily calibrate our relationship to danger, is our instinct to sever the relationship altogether rather than build the precision that would let us keep both the remedy and the risk? It seems to me that's commonplace in modern day pharmaceutical medicine when we have nearly every type of pharmaceutical has some sort of side effects, and we must approach it with caution and understand the risk. And taking it back to the philosophical, maybe the gift of community becomes more alive when we don't completely exile the dangerous elements, when we don't pretend that community has no shadow, but when we instead learn how much exposure, what type of preparation, what boundary lets helpful aspects come through without the harm. A type of buffer, if you will. A mature community, like a mature relationship with comfrey, doesn't run from its own poison. It learns how to work with it appropriately and safely. And when it can't yet trust itself to know how to do that, when there's no calibration there yet, maybe the more honest move isn't to deny everything, but restraint instead. After all, comfrey still offers itself externally, topically, at the surface, where the boundary is easier to hold. Perhaps that's one big teaching here. Intimacy with the dangerous part of anything doesn't have to mean full, unguarded access all at once. Sometimes the mature relationship is the one that finds the right layer of contact until trust and precision are earned. Comfrey is asking us to hold these things together without collapsing them into each other, to be strong enough to stand alone, to be generous enough to feed the ones around you without needing them to survive, and to be honest enough to know your own poison well enough to still safely offer your gift. In the Western world, comfrey's recorded association with bone knitting goes back to Dioscorides and Galen in the classical era, and its Latin genus name, Symphytum, comes from the Greek symphio, to unite or grow together. Medieval and early modern herbalists had it as a battlefield plant, literally packed into wound dressings and used to splint fractures in the field long before it was a garden guild material. Comfrey wasn't a folk footnote. It was actually foundational. Its 20th century turn towards controversy, the paralizidine alkaloid concerns that pulled internal use off the shelves in many countries by the 1980s to 2000s, is its own kind of story arc. A plant trusted uncritically for centuries and then feared uncritically for decades now slowly is being reapproached with the kind of precision it always actually required. We must understand that comfrey is a complex being with many parts working in synergy with each other, and it's through careful observation and study that we can better understand how to work with comfrey as a whole, not as its isolated parts. I'd like to offer this retelling of a myth called Nüwa Mends the Sky, and it's sourced from Chinese mythology. The Huinanzi and Leizu are the classical texts this comes from, and I'm sorry for any pronunciation errors, but I'll leave references in the show notes. Long before there were seasons to count, the sky was held up by four great pillars, and the world beneath it was whole. Then two gods, Gunggong, god of water, and Zhurong, god of fire, went to war over who would rule the heavens. Their battle tore across the sky and down into the earth, fire against flood, until Gunggong, defeated and consumed by his own rage, drove his head into Mount Buzhou, one of the four pillars holding up creation. The pillar cracked. The sky itself tore open at the wound. Fire poured from the gash where the heavens no longer sealed shut, and flood poured up from below where the earth could no longer hold its own weight. Wild beasts, no longer kept in check by a stable world, turned on the people. Everything that had depended on the sky being whole now had no floor and no ceiling at once. Nuwa, the mother who had shaped the first humans from clay, saw that her children were suffering and went to work. She did not reach for one solution. She reached for many because the wound was not one wound. For the torn sky itself, she searched the riverbeds for stones for five different colors. Not one kind of stone, five, and melted them together into a single molten substance, because no single color alone carried what the sky needed to become whole again. Only the blend, all five together, could patch what had been broken open. For the fallen pillar, one repair to the sky wasn't enough. The structure beneath it needed to be reestablished too, or the mended sky would only tear again. So she went to the great turtle, Ao, and took its four legs, setting one at each corner of the world to hold the heavens steady, four separate supports, each one doing a different corner's work, none of them able to hold up the sky alone. And even then, the world below was still burning and still flooding, so she gathered reeds from the riverbanks, burned them to ash, and used the ash to dam the rising water and choke the wildfire. A third, entirely different act of repair, because the sky being fixed did nothing yet for the ground still in ruin. Only once all of it was in place, the five-colored stone sealing the sky, the four turtle legs steadying the corners, the reed ash calming the flood and fire below, did the world become whole again. No one piece of what Nuwa did could have saved it by itself. The stone without the pillars would have patched a sky that had nothing holding it up. The pillars without the stone would have propped up a sky that still poured fire through its wound. And the dam without either would have left the heavens still broken above a calmer but doomed earth. It took the whole working together, mismatched materials, different fixes for different wounds, for the world to be made whole again. And I like to bring that in because that's the lesson and the myth that we can tie back to Comfrey. The praised compound in Comfrey, allantoin, alone in a lab, isn't the quote-unquote medicine. It's just one color of stone. The whole plant, known constituents and unknown ones together, is closer to what Nuwa understood instinctively. A wound doesn't fully mend by one thing alone. It heals through many different imperfect parts, each doing what only it can do, brought into relationship with the others. Let's talk about how we can actually work with Comfrey in our lives, but I also want to go a little bit deeper into why Comfrey was taken off the market for internal use and what the concerns are. So interestingly, Comfrey is one of the more studied topical herbs in modern phytotherapy. It also carries 2,000 years of traditional use, as we talked about, for wounds, fractures, and inflammation, and it's also been through a real body of randomized placebo-controlled clinical research. Although there are some flaws in the clinical research done for internal use. That combination is what makes it worth talking through carefully rather than just reciting the folklore. But both are important. For external efficacy, there are several fairly well-designed studies that exist, mostly using standardized comfrey root extract ointments, and the pattern across them is pretty consistent. If we look at a conglomerate of efficacy and safety reviews that pull in dozens of studies, comfrey preparations were repeatedly shown effective for pain, inflammation, and swelling in degenerative arthritis, acute muscle pain, and sprains and strains. To name just a couple, there was a trial of 142 patients with acute ankle sprains, and a comfrey root extract ointment was applied and showed significant superiority over the placebo. In a follow-up multi-center study comparing the same comfrey ointment against a 1% diclofenac gel, I guess it's a standard NSAID, the comfrey ointment was found not inferior to the pharmaceutical, and by day 5 treatment, satisfaction was rated good to excellent in nearly 90% of the comfrey group, compared to only 23% of the placebo group. For acute back pain, there was a multi-center randomized trial of 379 patients who found a comfrey-based cream notably reduced acute back pain with no serious adverse reactions reported. That's a pretty decent amount of controlled evidence for a topical botanical. This isn't just this people have used it for centuries. It's held up specifically against both placebo and pharmaceuticals. But let's talk about why there's so much concern around comfrey. And the concern is mainly about using it internally. Although sometimes it's taken out of context and extrapolated to external use, but really external use is pretty uncontested to be safe. As I mentioned briefly earlier, the main concern is about paralizidine alkaloids, or PAs for short. Actually a wide group of compounds, but some of these are capable of causing severe liver injury when they accumulate systemically. There's really nothing to debate about the isolated compound itself. Once ingested, PAs can cause liver destruction, resulting in sinusoidal obstruction syndrome. But here's the mechanism, and it's not what most people assume. PAs themselves are relatively benign on their own. It's the liver's own enzymes converting them into more excretable toxic pyrroles that turn them into highly reactive compounds which are capable of bonding to the tissue and causing damage. In effect, the liver's attempt to protect itself is actually what's creating the harm. What strikes me is that this mechanism isn't actually unique to PAs. Other compounds, like estrogen, work on a strikingly similar principle. The hormone itself isn't the danger, it's what the liver does with it during detoxification. When methylation and glucuronidation pathways are healthy, estrogen clears cleanly. When those pathways are sluggish or depleted, it gets shunted into more reactive, harmful metabolites instead. And this is like a deeper vitalist point underneath both. Toxicity isn't always a fixed property of a substance. It's a property of the relationship between the substance and the terrain that's processing it. The real question isn't just how much of it is safe, it's how supported is the system doing the work. And that's a question that herbalism or holistic health fields have typically been better at analyzing than isolated pharmacology. So here's where things get a little bit more nuanced. I think there are some real limits to the studies and case reports behind comfrey's internal use reputation. Not to say there's not some validity for safety and precaution around the use of comfrey internally. I think there's certainly warrants caution. The documented cases of hepatic veno-occlusive disease, which is now called sinusoidal obstruction syndrome, go back to reports in The Lancet from 1981, the British Medical Journal from 1987, and Gastroenterology from 1985. Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center's own summary notes that no confirmed deaths have been definitively attributed to comfrey alone, and some historical cases may actually be misidentification incidents, like comfrey has a genuinely toxic lookalike, which is foxglove. So most of this data comes from individual case reports, not controlled trials, and case reports can't establish a real dose-response relationship. No one has really a clean answer for how much, how often, or for how long actually causes harm in humans, because you can't ethically run that trial. I think it's worth naming that allopathic medicine will often treat a handful of case reports as sufficient evidence of harm, while also dismissing case-based evidence of an herb's efficacy as merely anecdotal. Comfrey sits right at that inconsistency. It's further complicated by the fact that the PA content can vary significantly by species, cultivar, growing conditions, and plant parts, meaning older pooled toxicity data may not map cleanly onto a specific plant someone is actually growing today. The animal research adds yet another layer, then resolving it. One foundational study used isolated, purified pyrrolizidine alkaloids extracted from Russian comfrey dosed at 200 milligrams per kilogram as a single dose, or 100 milligrams per kilogram three times weekly for 3 weeks, producing dose-dependent liver damage. That's an extremely high dose for a rat, Not to mention that it's an isolated compound, not the whole herb. The carcinogenicity study most often cited to establish Comfrey's tumor risk used whole root instead, fed at up to 8% of total diet for 12 weeks. Neither has a real analog to how anyone historically drank Comfrey tea or used it occasionally as food. Actual human case reports of injury generally involved regular consumption over months to years, not a single concentrated dose. That's a real gap between this mechanism is established and this is what typical human exposure produces. As with anything, even water, the poison is in the dose. I'd also like to take a look at this through a more vitalist whole plant lens. In this view, a plant is never just its constituents. It's a living whole. Its parts are held in relationship in the way, like the way that organs relate within a body. The instinct is obvious. Comfrey's tannins, mucilage, and unnamed compounds are surely in conversation with its alkaloids, tempering what they do alone. But I do want to remain honest, that relationship hasn't actually been demonstrated for Comfrey's PAs. No study has compared a matched PA dose as whole root against the same dose as purified isolate. And even in whole root form, high sustained doses still produce damage on some level. So if the matrix is buffering the alkaloids at all, it isn't buffering them into full safety. The right posture isn't claiming that science is wrong for isolating the parts. It's noticing the science hasn't yet asked the right questions, the ones that perhaps a vitalist would ask. And then to play devil's advocate with myself for a moment, I can understand some caution on the regulatory side. Liver injury is serious and often irreversible. There was no reliable way to guarantee a given supplement's PA content, especially not with the current regulations for supplements within the United States, and precaution on an unregulated, easily misdosed oral product is sort of a defensible use of a public health mandate, especially in a market where labeling and potency aren't standardized. That's a whole nother rabbit hole, one that I won't get down because I have very mixed feelings on this topic, as does the herbalist community as a whole. So where the heck does that leave us? Given how well the topical route works for many conditions, it may be the more conservative choice in most cases. It has real supporting safety data behind it, which is distinct from the oral risk that shaped Comfrey's reputation. If ingestion of Comfrey, and I am not suggesting this for anyone specifically, but if ingestion is warranted for a specific case, care should be taken to make sure that it is for shorter periods of time and that there's no existing liver disease. The older leaves of Comfrey contain less of the pyrrolizidine alkaloids than newer ones, and the roots contain even more PAs than either. Also, there may be differences between the different species as to how many PAs they each contain, but I couldn't find any reliable information on this. It seemed like it might change more with growing conditions and time of year that it's harvested, but it would be great if somebody did more research in that area. Or if you know of anything, please send it my way. And here's one more thing that I want to repeat. I'm not here to tell you what to do with your own body. What I can offer is information. What you do with that information, especially if you're growing this plant yourself, is your call. There's a real difference between an unregulated supplement of unknown alkaloid content and one that you're growing yourself and have a relationship with. Personal agency and informed self-responsibility are part of what it means to work with plants as health allies rather than simply consuming a product. I'm laying this out so you can decide with real knowledge, and I'm not going to instruct you either way. But I would like to talk more about historical use, and I know this is getting pretty long. This podcast episode is longer than most that I've done, but I felt like it was really worth digging into this topic of internal ingestion with Comfrey because it's just such a nuanced conversation. All right, so let's look at some of the ways that humans have worked with Comfrey traditionally. And this is an herb that has been worked with historically, both internally and externally, as I already mentioned earlier. Traditionally, the root and leaf have both been poulticed and used directly onto fractures, sprains, bruises, and wounds to help knit the tissues and bones back together. Infused oils have also been made, and those can be turned into salves for joint pain and muscle strain. It can be used as washes or compresses for skin irritation and swelling. I personally have used comfrey in all of these ways, and it's been an invaluable herb in my home apothecary. In fact, recently I've been dealing with a neck injury, and although I'm also seeking medical care, comfrey has been an important ally in my recovery process, as I feel it's really helped with the stability of my connective tissue and overall gives me a little bit of relief for the pain and other symptoms that I've been experiencing. Also, my husband recently had some bug bites that he couldn't stop itching, so they turned into sores and nothing was helping. So we ended up doing comfrey poultices on his arm for a few days in a row. We would cover mashed up comfrey with a plastic baggie and then put one of those sleeves that you can get to prevent your arms from getting sunburned over top. It's kind of like a compression sleeve. And he would just keep it on there like half the day, and then we would just keep reapplying that. And it was absolutely incredible how quickly those wounds went away. And it also provided him a lot of relief from wanting to itch that spot. As I mentioned, I just wanted to reiterate that topical use of comfrey is quite safe and has the studies to prove that. So internally, the historical record shows that comfrey has been taken as tea or tonic for coughs and respiratory congestion, as a soothing agent for gastrointestinal ulcers, and as a general system tonic. If you crush up a fresh comfrey leaf, you can see this beautiful mucilage that forms, and that is going to coat and cool down and soothe irritated tissues. And those tissues could be externally, like we talked about, but historically it's also been used internally for those exact same qualities. And this internal use goes back through Dioscorides and Galen and persisted into folk and eclectic herbal practice well into the 20th century, before the paralizidine alkaloid research reshaped how it was regarded. As I mentioned, there are a lot of differing opinions today within the herbalist community. Some herbalists have been working with comfrey themselves for close to 50 years, while other herbalists say that internal ingestion just is not worth the risk. Ultimately, the decision whether or not to use comfrey internally for yourself is completely up to you, but I do encourage you to understand the precautions around using it internally. And all of the information we talked about earlier will hopefully help you make a decision that's right for you. You are the one who knows your own body best. I wanted to also mention that comfrey is an incredible garden ally, and this harkens back to this idea of community. Its fast-growing nature and ability to pull nutrients from down deep in the soil makes it a top choice plant for mulching and fertilizing a garden. It can be used by either chopping up and dropping the leaves directly on the ground around garden plants, or chopping the leaves and allowing them to infuse in a bucket of water, similar to a strong tea, and then using this as liquid fertilizer. Comfrey loves to care for the community around it, and sometimes that community is in the form of a garden. I do have a few more precautions worth naming. Comfrey's speed at helping our body repair tissue is part of what makes it so remarkable, but that same speed is also exactly why it needs to be used with some caution rather than applied indiscriminately. On open wounds, comfrey's tissue proliferative action can actually work against healing rather than for it in some cases. Because allantoin drives such rapid surface cell growth, it can cause the outer layers of a wound to close before the deeper tissue has finished healing underneath, which may sometimes seal in bacteria, debris, or infection that hasn't had a chance to clear. This is why the traditional caution has always been to avoid comfrey on deep or gaping wounds until they've started to close on their own, and why it's better suited to bruises, sprains, more shallow injuries and closed injuries rather than deep puncture wounds or deep wounds in general. On fractures, the same speed applies to bone. If a break isn't properly set before comfrey is used, its rapid knitting action can begin fusing the bone in a misaligned position, meaning the fracture may heal crookedly, sometimes requiring the bone to be rebroken and reset correctly afterwards. Ouch. This is exactly one of the oldest recorded cautions around the plant. It's part of why traditional herbalists and bone setters work together rather than in isolation. The plant does its part remarkably well, but only once the structural alignment is correct. And in that sense, I love how comfrey is nodding to this idea of community once again. Okay, so as is typical with this podcast, I would love to end this episode with some reflection questions. So let's dive in and grab a pen and paper if you'd like to write them down. Where in your life are you being asked to knit something back together? Not by force, but by calling its own capacity to heal. What do you draw from your community, and how do you offer to your community in a way that is sourced from abundance rather than obligation? Who, what, or where do you draw your deep nutrients from? And lastly, is there a poison, a shadow, a danger, a hard truth inside something you love or belong to? What would it look like to know its exact dose rather than to deny or fear it? Thank you so much for joining me on another episode. Please join me in my Patreon group. I hope to interact with you again soon.
I am so excited to keep sharing the wisdom of plants and poetry with all of you. If you enjoy this journey and would like to help support this podcast, whether energetically, financially, or just by sharing it with a friend, I would be so grateful. Your support helps to keep this space alive, allows me to continue exploring new herbs, crafting new episodes, and sharing inspiration with you. One of the easiest ways to support this podcast is to rate and review it in your favorite podcast app. You can also join our Remedy and Rhyme Patreon page, which is available at patreon.com/joyfulroots. You'll find all sorts of goodies there, including plant stories, recipes, and more. There is a free membership, but if you are able to help support the podcast, there are some great perks with the paid memberships. And also, I have a shop on Patreon where you can easily purchase educational material like a class or a zine and further your own herbal knowledge. Another way that you can support the podcast is by getting yourself some of the most amazing matcha on the planet. It's Posana Matcha. It's certified organic, third-party tested to ensure that it's free of heavy metals, pure, safe, and absolutely delicious. This is the matcha that I always turn to because I know it's the highest quality and I just love it so much. So I'm excited that I can offer everybody that listens to this podcast 15% off if you use the coupon code JOYFULROOTS. You can find the link in the show notes or head to posana.net, that's posana.net, and use the coupon code JOYFULROOTS at checkout. Although I love sharing my poetry with you, I really would love to make this a community collaborative effort. So don't be shy. Feel free to send some poetry in my way. And I'm going to keep a running list of plants that I'd like to talk about in the future. You can find that list on my website at joyfulroots.com/plantpoems. That's PLANTPOEMS. Thank you to Akun Baradine for their music, Bedtime After Coffee, which was in the intro and outro, and also to Lights by Sakura Girl, and Asher Fulero for Exploring the Crystal Caves, which was the music you heard in the middle of the podcast. And thank you so much to the plants, number one, the greatest of all herbal teachers, to all of the herbalists that I've learned from. There's just too many to name. and for all of my family and friends for supporting me on this podcast journey. And to all of my amazing patrons and customers and clients, this really wouldn't be possible without you. So thank you again.